Chapter 44. Unknown to Pitt, his days of lonely bachelorhood would be temporarily interrupted. He returned to his hangar and observed that wily old Sandecker had sent a security team to patrol the area around him at the deserted end of the airport. He didn't question the Admiral's concern for his safety. He didn't feel it was necessary, despite Zale's threats, but he was grateful all the same. The real reason did not become apparent until he entered the hangar and climbed to his apartment above the main floor. The music coming out of his stereo system was on an easy listening station instead of his preferred modern jazz. Then he smelled the aroma of coffee. He also detected the wisp of a fragrant feminine scent. He peered into the kitchen and found Sally Morse stirring the contents of an array of pots on the stove. She was in bare feet, wearing a sundress and little else. "Who invited you? Who said you could invade my personal domain as if you owned it? Who let you in through the security systems?" All these questions ripened in his mind, but, mild-mannered marine engineer that he was, Pitt simply said, "Hello. What's for dinner?" "Beef stroganoff," answered Sally, turning and smiling sweetly. "Do you like it?" "One of my favorites." She could tell by the adrift expression on his face that he hadn't expected her. "Congresswoman Smith thought I'd be safer staying here, especially since Admiral Sandecker has placed a security ring around your hangar." Questions answered, Pitt opened the cabinet above his bar to pour a drink. "Lauren told me you drink tequila, so I took the liberty of making margaritas. I hope you don't mind." Though Pitt preferred his expensive tequila straight over ice with a touch of lime and light salt rimming the glass, he enjoyed a well-mixed margarita. They were better made with cheaper tequila, though. To his way of thinking, it was a crime to dilute the top quality brands with sweet mix. He looked forlornly at his half-empty bottle of good Juan Julio Silver 100% Blue Agave tequila. Just to be polite, he complimented Sally on the taste and went to his bedroom to take a shower and change into comfortable shorts and t-shirt. His bedroom looked as if a bomb had gone off in it. Shoes and various items of female apparel littered the polished wooden plank floor. Bottles of nail polish and other cosmetics were stacked on the dresser and the bed's end tables. Why do women always drop their clothes on the floor? He wondered. Men at least throw them over a chair. He couldn't believe only one female could have created such chaos until he heard a voice humming in his bathroom. The door was ajar, so he very slowly eased it half open with his toe. Kelly was standing in front of a half-steamed mirror, wearing a towel around her body and a smaller one wrapped around her head. She was putting on eye makeup. She saw Pitt's blank stare in the mirror and smiled engagingly. "Welcome home. I hope Sally and I haven't upset your routine."
"It was suggested you stay here, too?" he asked.
"Lauren thought it safer than her place. And the government safe houses could not be trusted because of Zale's infiltration into the Justice Department."
"Sorry, I have only one bedroom in the apartment. I hope you and Ms. Morse don't mind sharing the bed."
"It's king size," Kelly said, returning to her makeup as if she and Pitt had lived together for years. "We won't mind." Then, as an afterthought, "I'm sorry, would you like to use the bathroom?"
"Don't mind me," Pitt said wryly. "I'll pack some clothes and shower downstairs in the guest quarters."
Sally had stepped from the kitchen. "I fear we have inconvenienced you."
"I'll survive," Pitt said as he began throwing some things in an overnight bag. "You ladies make yourselves at home."
From his dry tone, Sally and Kelly could tell that Pitt wasn't overjoyed at their intrusion.
"We'll stay out of your way," promised Kelly.
"Don't get me wrong," Pitt said, sensing her uneasiness.
You're not the first ones who have stayed here and slept in my bed. I adore women and am actually quite fond of their curious mannerisms. I come from the old school that elevates them on a pedestal, so don't think I'm a nasty old grunt. He paused and grinned. Actually, it will be enjoyable having a pair of gorgeous creatures like yourselves cooking and cleaning house for me. Then he walked from the bedroom and down the circular stairway to the main floor below. Sally and Kelly watched in silence as he disappeared from view. Then they turned, looked at each other, and broke out laughing. My God, burst Sally. Is he for real? Take my word for it, said Kelly. He's bigger than life. Pitt set up house in the Manhattan Limited Pullman railroad car that sat on rails along one wall of the hangar. A relic from a Hudson River search operation several years ago, he used it as guest quarters when visitors and friends stayed with him. Giordino often borrowed it for the night when he wanted to impress one of his string of lady friends. Women found the luxurious antique railroad car a very exotic setting for a romantic evening. He had stepped from the shower and was shaving when the extension phone in the Pullman car rang. He picked up the receiver and simply said, Hello? Dirk, St. Julian Perlmutter's voice boomed in Pitt's ear. How are you, my boy? Fine, St. Julian. Where are you? Amiens, France. I spent the day talking to Jules Verne scholars. Tomorrow I have an appointment with Dr. Paul Heroux, president of the Jules Verne Society. He has graciously given me permission to conduct research in the Society's archives, which are inside the house where Verne lived and wrote until his death in 1905. Verne was an amazing man, you know. I had no idea. A true visionary. He established the genre of science fiction, of course, but he also anticipated flights to the moon, submarines that could circle the globe underwater, solar heating, moving escalators and walkways, three-dimensional holographic images. You name it, he was there first. He also foresaw asteroids and comets striking the Earth and causing wide devastation. Discover any new revelations about Captain Nemo and the Nautilus? Nothing beyond what Verne wrote in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea and The Mysterious Island. That was the sequel, right? The one that told what happened to Nemo after the Nautilus was lost in a maelstrom off the Norwegian coast. Yes, 20,000 Leagues came out in 1869 as a magazine serial. The Mysterious Island in 1875 revealed the history and biography of Nemo. From what I gathered from Dr. Egan's research on Verne, he seemed fascinated by how the author created Nemo and his submarine. Egan must have believed that Verne had more than a brilliant imagination working for him. I think Egan thought Verne built the story around a real person. I'll know more in a couple of days, said Perlmutter. But don't get your hopes up. Jules Verne's tales, however ingeniously clever, were fiction. Captain Nemo may have been one of the greatest protagonists in literature, but really he was nothing more than the precursor of the mad scientist, out to exact revenge for past wrongs. The noble genius gone wrong. Still, Pitt persisted, for Verne to have created a technical marvel like the Nautilus from the keel up in his own mind seems incredible. Unless Jules Verne was the Leonardo da Vinci of his time, he must have had technical advice above and beyond what was generally thought available in 1869. From the real Captain Nemo? Asked Perlmutter cynically. Or some other engineering genius? Pitt answered seriously. You don't appreciate true genius, said Perlmutter. I may glean new details from the archives, but I'm not betting my life savings on the outcome. It's been many years since I read the books, said Pitt. But Nemo was a man of mystery in 20,000 Leagues. If I recall, it wasn't until near the end of The Mysterious Island that Verne offered an insight into Nemo. Chapter 16, Perlmutter recited. Nemo was born the son of a Raja in India. Prince Dakar, as he was named, was an exceptionally gifted and intelligent child. Verne described him as growing up handsome, extremely wealthy, and full of hatred for the British who had conquered his country. His lust for revenge affected his thinking as he grew older, especially after he led and fought in the Sepoy Rebellion in 1857. In revenge, British agents seized and murdered his father, mother, wife, and two children. During the years he brooded over the loss of his family and country, he threw himself into the science of marine engineering. On a remote, uninhabited island in the Pacific, he used his wealth to build a shipyard where he created the Nautilus. Verne wrote that Nemo harnessed electricity long before Tesla and Edison built their generators. The engines in the submarine powered the boat indefinitely without the need of refueling or regeneration. Makes me wonder if Verne didn't envision Dr. Egan's magneto-hydrodynamic engines. After completing his undersea vessel, continued Perlmutter, he brought on a loyal crew and vanished under the sea. Then in 1867 he took on three castaways who had fallen off an American Navy frigate that he had attacked. They recorded his secret existence and voyaged around the world with him underwater. The castaways, a professor, his servant, and a Canadian fisherman, escaped when the Nautilus sailed into the maelstrom and Nemo disappeared. By the time he was 60 years old, his crew had died, and he was interred in a coral cemetery beneath the sea. Alone with his beloved submarine, Nemo spent his final years in a cavern beneath a volcano on Lincoln Island. After aiding castaways on the island against pirates and helping them to leave and sail home, he died of natural causes. The volcano then erupted and Lincoln Island sank beneath the sea, burying Captain Nemo and his extraordinary Nautilus in the depths, where they are now enshrined in fictional history. But was it fiction, Pitt mused, or based on nonfiction? You'll never sell me that Nemo is anything more than a figment of Verne's imagination, said Perlmutter in a quiet, authoritative voice. Pitt said nothing for a few moments. He did not fool himself. He was chasing shadows. If only I knew what Dr. Egan discovered about the Vikings and Captain Nemo, he said at last. Perlmutter sighed patiently. I fail to see a connection between two such totally different topics. Egan was a fanatic on both. I can't help but feel they somehow tied in with each other. I doubt that he uncovered any previously undiscovered facts on either. Certainly nothing that hasn't already been recorded. St. Julian, you're an old cynic. I'm a historian, and I do not chronicle or publish anything I can't document. Enjoy yourself in those dusty old archives, said Pitt humorously. Nothing stirs my blood more than finding a new angle on history in a forgotten log or letter. Except, of course, the taste of fine wine, or a gourmet meal prepared by a great chef. Of course, Pitt said, smiling to himself as he pictured Perlmutter's great girth, which was a direct result of excessive indulgence in food and drink. I will call should I turn up anything of interest. Thank you. Pitt hung up the phone as Sally Morse called from the balcony above that dinner was ready. He shouted an acknowledgement but did not immediately leave the Pullman car and walk up the staircase. Now that he was removed from any role in the operation to stop Curtis Merlin's Ale, the murderous Viper organization, and the Cerberus cartel, Pitt felt lost, without direction. It was not his nature to sit powerless on the outside looking in. He had run out of road, and he wished to high heaven that he had turned off earlier and turned down one he'd overlooked.